The little old people were unusually solemn, Santen noticed, as they adjusted their cloaks and carrying satchels, and Hani came to her and checked the sling of her bag, then knelt to adjust the canvas booties bound around Santan's feet. "What is it?" Their serious mien made Santen uneasy. Hani understood the question, but did not try to explain. Instead, she called Santen, and the two of them fell in behind Owa. Owa raised his voice. "Spirit of Moon, make a light for us in this night, to show us the path." He used the cracked falsetto tone, which all the spirits particularly enjoyed, and he performed a few shuffling dance steps in the sand. "Spirit of Great Sun, sleep well, and when you rise tomorrow, be not angry. Let your anger burn us up in the singing sands. Then, when we have passed safely through and have reached the sipwells, we will dance for you and sing our thanks." He finished the short dance with a leap and a stamp of his small, childlike feet. That was enough for now, a small down payment, with the balance promised when the spirits had honoured their part of the contract. "Come, old grandmother," he said. "Make sure that a numb child stays close and does not fall behind. You know that we cannot turn back to search for her if she does." And in that quick swaying jog, he started up the slope of beach into the mouth of the valley, just as the moon broke clear of the darkening horizon and started its journey across the starry heavens. It was strange to travel in the night, for the desert seemed to take on new and mysterious dimensions. The dunes seemed taller and closer, decked in silver moonlight and dark purple shadows, and the valleys between them were canyons of silence, while above it all the vast panoply of the stars and the Milky Way and the moon were closer and brighter than Santan had ever believed possible. She had the illusion that by simply reaching up she could pluck them down like ripe fruit from the bough. The memory of the ocean stayed with them long after it was out of sight. The soft hiss of their footsteps in the sand seemed to echo its gentle kissing surf on the yellow beaches, and the air was still cooled by its vast green waters. They had been following the valley for almost a half of the moon's rise to its zenith, when suddenly Santan trotted into an eddy of heat. After the ocean-cooled airs, it was like running into a solid barrier. Santan gasped with surprise, and Hani murmured without breaking the rhythm of her gait, "Now it begins." But they passed swiftly through it, and beyond the air was so cold by contrast that Santan shivered and drew her cloak closer about her shoulders. The valley twisted, and as they came around the corner of a towering dune on which the moon shadows lay like bruises, the desert breathed upon them again. "Stay close, Namchild." But the heat had a viscosity and weight so that Santen felt that she was wading into a lava flow. At midnight, it was hotter than in the boiler room at Mortom, with the furnace stoked with oak logs. And as she breathed it into her lungs, she felt the heat entering her body like an invader, and with each breath expelled, she could feel it taking her moisture like a thief. They paused once, only briefly, and drank from an egg bottle. Both Hani and Owa watched carefully as Santen lifted it to her lips, but neither of them had to caution her now. When the sky began to lighten, Owa slackened his pace a little and once or twice paused to survey the valley with a critical eye. It was obvious that he was choosing a place to wait out the day, and when at last they halted, it was close under the lee of a steep dune hill. There was no material for a fire, and Hani offered Santan a piece of sun-dried fish wrapped in seaweed. But she was too tired and hot to eat, and afraid also that food would increase her thirst during the day ahead. She drank her ration of water from the egg bottle and then wearily stood up and moved a short distance from the others. But as soon as she squatted, Harney let out a shrill reprimand and hurried to her. "No," she repeated. And San Tan was embarrassed and confused, until the old woman fished in her satchel and brought out the dried wild gourd that she used as a bowl and ladle. "Here, this one," she proffered it to San Tan, who still did not understand. Exasperated, the old woman snatched back the gourd and, holding it between her own legs, urinated into it. "Here, do," she offered the bowl to San Tan again.
"I can't, Annie, not in front of everybody,"
San Tan protested modestly.
"Oa, come here," Hani called. "Show the child."
The old man came across and noisily reinforced Hani's demonstration. Despite her embarrassment, San Tan could not help feeling a touch of envy.
"How much more convenient. Now do."
Hani offered her the gourd once again, and San Tan capitulated. She turned away modestly, and with both the old people encouraging her loudly, she added her own tinkling stream to the communal gourd. Harney bore it away triumphantly.
"Hurry, Nam child," she beckoned. "The sun will come soon."
And she showed San Tan how to scoop a shallow trench in the sand in which to lie. The sun struck the face of the dune on the opposite side of the valley, and it flung reflected heat at them like a mirror of polished bronze. They lay in the strip of shade and cringed into their trenches. The sun rose higher and the dune shadow shrank. The heat rose and filled the valley with silvery mirage, so that the dunes began to dance, and then the sand started to sing. It was a low but pervading vibration, as though the desert was the sounding box of gigantic string instrument. It rose and fell and died away and then started again.
"The sands are singing,"
Hani told her quietly, and San Tan understood. She lay with her ear to the sound and listened to the strange and wonderful music of the desert. Still the heat increased, and following the example of the sand, San Tan covered her head with a canvas shawl and lay quietly. It was too hot to sleep, but she fell into a sort of stupefied coma and rode the long swelling waves of heat as though they were the sound of the sea. Still, it became hotter, and the shade shriveled away as the sun nooned, and there was no relief or asylum from its merciless lash. San Tan lay and panted like a maimed animal, and each quick and shallow breath seemed to abrade her throat and burn the strength from her body.
"It can't get worse," she told herself. "This is the end of it. Soon it will begin to cool."
She was wrong. The heat grew stronger yet, and the desert hissed and vibrated like a tortured beast, and San Tan was almost afraid to open her eyes, lest it sear her eyeballs. Then she heard the old woman moving, and she lifted the corner of her head cover and watched her carefully, mixing sand into the gourdful of urine. She brought the bowl to where San Tan lay and plastered the wet sand over her baking skin. San Tan gasped with relief at the cool touch of it, and before it could dry in the fierce heat, Hani filled in the shallow trench with loose sand, burying San Tan under a thin layer and then arranging the shawl over her head.
"Thank you, Hani," San Tan whispered, and the old woman went to cover her husband.
With the damp sand next to her skin and the protective layer over that, San Tan lasted out those hottest hours of the desert day, and then, with that African suddenness, she felt the temperature on her cheeks change, and the sunlight was no longer stark, dazzling white, but shaded with a mellow, buttery tone. At nightfall they rose out of their beds and shook themselves, throwing off the sand. They drank in a transport that was almost religious, but again San Tan could not force herself to eat, and then Owa led them off. Now there was no novelty or fascination for San Tan in the night's trek, and the heavenly bodies were no longer marvels to gaze upon with awe, but merely instruments to mark the long, tortuous passage of the hours. The earth beneath her changed its character from loose sand that gave under each step and dragged at her feet to hard, compacted mica flats, where the flower-like crystals called desert roses had edges to them like knives. They cut through her canvas sandals, and she had to pause to rebind them. Then they left the flats and crossed the low spine of a sub-dune, and from its crest saw another vast valley yawn before them. Owa never wavered or showed the least hesitation. Although Santan realized that these mountains of sands would walk before the prevailing winds, endlessly changing shape, trackless and unknowable, yet the little man moved through them the way a master mariner rides upon the shifting currents of the ocean. The silence of the desert seemed to enter Santan's head like molten wax, deadening her sense of hearing, filling her eardrums with the susurrations of nothingness, as though she held a seashell to her ear.
"Will this sand never end?" she asked herself. "Is this a continent of dunes?"
In the dawn they halted and prepared their defences to resist the siege of the sun. And in the hottest hour of the day, as Santan lay in her shallow grave-like bed, coated with urine damp sand, she felt her baby move within her more strongly this time, as though he too were fighting the heat and the thirst.
"Patience, my darling," she whispered to him. "Save your strength. We must learn the lessons and the ways of this land, so that we will never have to suffer like this again. Never again."
That evening, when she rose from the sand, she ate a little of the dried fish for the baby's sake. But, as she had feared, the food made her thirst almost insupportable. However, the strength it gave her bore her up through the night's journey. She did not waste strength by speaking aloud. All three of them were conserving energy and moisture, no unnecessary words or actions. But Santan looked up at the sky as it made its grand and ponderous revolution, and she could still see Michael's star standing across the black void of the South Pole from her own.
"Please, let it end," she prayed silently to his star. "Let it end soon, for I don't know how much longer I can go on."
But it did not end, and it seemed that the nights grew longer, the sand deeper and more cloying around her feet, while each day seemed fiercer than the last, and the heat beat down upon them like a blacksmith's hammer strokes on the iron of the anvil. Santan found that she had lost track of the days and the nights. They had blended in her mind into a single endless torment of heat and thirst.
5 days or six or even seven? She wondered vaguely,
and then she counted the empty egg bottles.
It must be six, she decided. Only 2 full bottles left.
Santan and Hani each placed 1 of the full bottles in their pack, sharing the load exactly. Then they ate the last shreds of dried fish and stood up to face the night's journey. But this time it did not begin immediately. Owa stared for a while into the east, turning his head slightly from side to side, as though he were listening. And for the first time Santan detected a fine shade of uncertainty in the way he held his small head with its crown-like nimbus of arrow shafts. Then Owa began to sing softly in what Santan had come to recognize as his ghost voice.
"Spirit of great lion star," he looked up to Sirius shining in the constellation of Canis Major, "you are the only one who can see us here, for all the other spirits avoid the land of singing sand. We are alone, and the journey is harder than I remember it when I passed here as a young man. The path has become obscure, great lion star, but you have the bright eye of a vulture and can see it all. Lead us, I beg of you. Make the path clear for us."
Then he took the egg bottle from Hani's satchel and drew the stopper and piled a little of the water onto the sand. It formed small round balls, and San Tan made a little moaning sound in her throat and sank onto her knees.
"See, spirit of great lion star, we share water with you,"
Owa sang and replugged the bottle. But San Tan stared at the little wet balls of sand and moaned again.
"Peace, Nam child,"
Hani whispered to her.
"To receive a special boon, it is sometimes necessary to give up what is precious."
She took San Tan's wrist and pulled her gently to her feet, and then turned to follow Owa over the endless dunes. With the silences deafening her, and weariness a crushing burden to carry, and thirst a raging torment, San Tan struggled on, once again losing all sense of time or distance or direction, seeing nothing but the two dancing figures ahead of her, transformed by the rays of the waning moon into tiny hobgoblins. They stopped so suddenly that San Tan ran into Hani and would have fallen had not the old woman steadied her and then quietly drawn her down until they lay side by side.
"What?"
San Tan began. But Hani placed a hand over her mouth to quieten her. Owa lay beside them, and when San Tan was quiet, he pointed over the lip of the dune on which they were lying. 200 feet below, at the dune's foot, began a level plain, awash with soft, silver moonlight. It reached to the very limit of San Tan's night vision, flat, without end, and it gave her hope that at last the dunes were behind them. Upon this plain stood a scattered forest of long-dead trees. Leprous grey in the moonlight, they lifted the blighted and twisted limbs of arthritic beggars to an uncaring sky. The weird scene invoked in San Tan a superstitious chill, and when something large but shapeless moved amongst the ancient trees like a monster from mythology, she shivered and wriggled closer to Hani. Both the San were trembling with eagerness, like hunting dogs on the leash, and Hani shook San Tan's hand and pointed silently. As San Tan's eyes adjusted, she saw that there were more living shapes than the one she had first spotted. But they were as still as great prey boulders. She counted 5 of them altogether. Lying on his side, Owa was restringing his little hunting bow, and when he had tested the tension of its string, he selected a pair of arrows from the leather band around his forehead, made a sign to Hani, and then slithered back from the crest of the dune. Once he was off the skyline, he leaped to his feet and slipped away into the shadows and folds of wind-blown sands. The two women lay behind the ridge, still and silent as the shadows. San Tan was learning the animal patience that this ancient wilderness demanded of all its creatures. The sky began to bloom with the first promise of day, and now she could see more clearly the creatures on the plain below them. There were huge antelopes, 4 of them lying quietly, while one of them, larger and more thick-set in shoulders and neck, stood a little apart. San Tan judged that he was the herd bull, for at his shoulder he stood as tall as Nuage, her beloved stallion, but he carried a magnificent pair of horns, long and straight and vicious, and San Tan was reminded vividly of the tapestry La Dame à la Licorne at the Musée de Cluny, which her father had taken her to see on her 12th birthday. The light strengthened, and the bull gleamed a lovely, soft, mulberry fawn colour. His face was marked with darker lines in a diamond pattern that looked as though he were wearing a head halter, but there was that wild dignity about him that immediately dispelled any suggestion of captivity. He swung his noble head towards where Santin lay, extended his trumpet-like ears, and swished his dark, bushy, horse-like tail uneasily. Hani laid her hand on Santan's arm, and they shrank down. The bull stared in their direction for many minutes, rigid and still as a marble carving, but neither of the women moved, and at last the bull lowered his head and began to dig in the loose earth of the plain with his sharp black forehoofs.
"Ah, yes, dig for the sweet root of the biplant, great and splendid bull,"
Owa exhorted him silently.
"Do not lift your head, you marvellous chieftain of Olchemsbok. Feed well, and I will dance you such a dance that all the spirits of the Chemsbok will envy you forever."
Owa lay 150 feet from where the Chemsbok bull was standing, still far beyond the range of his puny bow. He had left the shadow of the dune valley almost an hour before, and in that time had covered less than 500 paces. There was a slight depression in the surface of the plain, a mere indentation less than a hand span deep. But even in the vague light of the moon, Owa had picked it out unerringly with his hunter's eye, and he had slid into it like a small amber-coloured serpent, and like a serpent moved on his belly with slow, sinuous undulations and silent prayers to the spirits of Lion Star who had guided him to this quarry. Suddenly, the Chemsbok flung up his head and stared about him suspiciously, ears flared wide.
"Don't be alarmed, sweet bull," Owa urged him. "Smell the bad tuba and let peace enter your hut again."
The minutes stretched out, and then the bull blew a small, fluttery sound through his nostrils and lowered his head. His harem of fawn-coloured cows, who had been watching him wearily, relaxed, and their jaws began working again as they chewed on the cud. Owa slithered forward, moving under the flattened lip of the depression, his cheek touching the earth so as not to show a head silhouette, pushing himself over the soft earth with his hips and his knees and his toes. The Chemsbok had rooted out the tuber and was chewing on it with noisy gusto, holding it down with a forehoof to break off a mouthful, and Owa closed the gap between them with elaborate, patient stealth.
"Feast well, sweet bull. Without you, the three persons and an unborn child will be dead by tomorrow's sun. Do not go, great Chemsbok. Stay a while, just a little while longer."
He was as close as he dared approach now, but it was still too far. The Chemsbok's hide was tough, and his fur thick. The arrow was a light reed, and the point was bone that could not take the same keen edge as iron.
"Spirit of Lion Star, do not turn your face away now," Owa beseeched,
and raised his left hand so that the tiny pale-coloured palm was turned towards the bull. For almost a minute nothing happened. And then the bull noticed the disembodied hand that seemed to rise out of the earth, and he lifted his head and stared at it. It seemed too small to be dangerous. After a minute of utter stillness, Owa wriggled his fingers seductively, and the bull blew through his nostrils and stretched out his muzzle, sucking in air, trying to get the scent. But Owa was working into the small, fitful morning breeze with a deceptive dawn light behind him. He held his hand still again, and then slowly lowered it to his side. The bull took a few paces towards him and then froze. Another few paces, craning inquisitively, ears pricked forward, he peered at the shallow indentation where Owa lay pressed to the earth without breathing. Then the bull's curiosity took him forward again into range of Owa's bow. In a flash of movement, like the strike of the adder, Owa rolled onto his stride, drew the eagle feather flights to his cheek, and let the arrow fly. It darted like a bee across the space between them and alighted with a slapping sound on the patterned cheek of the bull, fixing its barbs in the soft skin below his trumpet-like ear. The bull reared back at the sting of it and whirled away. Instantly his harem cows sprang from their sandy couches into full gallop, and the whole herd went away after the running bull, switching their long dark tails and dragging a pale train of dust behind them. The bull was shaking his head, trying to rid himself of the arrow that dangled from his cheek, and he swerved in his run and deliberately brushed his head against the trunk of one of the ancient dead trees.
"Stick deep!" Owa was on his feet, capering and yelling. "Hold fast, Eru. Carry the poison of Owa to his heart. Carry it swiftly, little Eru."
The women came running down from the dune to join them.
"Oh, what a cunning hunter!"
Hani lauded her husband, and San Ten was breathless but disappointed, for the herd was already out of sight across the dark plain, lost in the grey of pre-dawn.
"Gone?" she asked Hani. "Wait," the old woman answered. "Follow soon. Watch now. Owa make magic."
The old man had laid aside his weapons, except for two arrows which he arranged in his headband to prick up at the same angle as the horns of a chemsbok. Then he cupped his hands on each side of his head into a trumpet-shaped ears, and subtly altered his entire stance and the way he carried his head. He snorted through his nostrils and pawed at the ground, and before Santan's eyes was transformed into a chemsbok. The mimicry was so faithful that Santan clapped her hands delightedly. Owa went through the pantomime of seeing the beckoning hand, approaching it wearily, and then being struck by the arrow. Santan had a sense of déjà vu, so accurately was the incident portrayed. Owa galloped away with the same stride and carriage as the chemsbok, but then he began to weaken and stagger. He was panting, his head drooping, and Santan felt a pang of sympathy for the stricken beast. She thought of Nuaj, and tears sprang into her eyes, but Hani was clapping and uttering little shrieks of encouragement.
"Die, O bull, that we revere! Die, that we may live!"
Owa blundered in a wide circle, his horned head too heavy to carry, and he sagged to the earth and went into the final convulsions as the poison coursed through his blood. It was all so convincing that San Tan was no longer seeing the little San, but rather the bull that he was portraying. She did not for a moment doubt the efficacy of the sympathetic spell that Owa was weaving over his quarry.
"Ah!" Hani cried. "He is down! The great bull is finished!"
And San Tan believed without question. They drank from the egg bottles, and then Owa broke a straight branch from one of the dead trees and shaped one end to fit the spearhead made from the thigh bone of a buffalo which he carried in his pouch. He bound the spearhead in place and weighed the heavy weapon in his hand.
"It is time to go after the bull," he announced, and led off across the plain.
Santan's first impression was correct. They had passed beyond the dune country, but the plain that lay ahead of them was every bit as forbidding, and the strange shapes of the dead forest gave it surreal and otherworldly feeling. Santan wondered how long ago the forest had died, and shivered as she realized that these trees might have stood like this for 1,000 years, preserved by the desiccated air as the mummies of the pharaohs had been. Owa was following the tracks of the chemsbok herd, and even over the hard, pebbled expanses of the plain where Santan could see no sign of their passing, the little San led them at a confident, unwavering trot. He paused only once to pick up the shaft of his arrow, lying at the base of the dead tree upon which the bull had brushed itself. He held it up and showed it to the women.
"See, the barb has struck."
The head of the arrow was missing. Owa had deliberately designed it in two pieces, with a weak section just at the back of the poisoned barb, so that it would break away. The light improved swiftly, and Hane, trotting ahead of Santan, pointed with her digging stick. At first Santan could not see what she was indicating. Then she noticed a small dried vine with a few parched brown leaves lying close to the earth, the first sign of living plant life since they had left the coast. Because she now knew where and how to look, Santan noticed other plants, brown and blasted and insignificant, but she had learned enough of this desert to guess what lay beneath the surface. It gave her spirits a small lift when she noticed the first scattered clumps of fine, silver-dry desert grass. The dunes were behind them, and the land about them was coming alive again. The morning breeze that had aided Owa in his stalk persisted after the sun had cleared the horizon, so the heat was not as oppressive as it had been in the dune country. The whole temper of the San was lighter and more carefree, and even without Hani's assurances, "Good now, eat, drink soon," Santen was sure that they had passed through the worst stage of the journey. She had to screw up her eyes and shade them, for already the low sun sparkled in a dazzling point of white light from the mica chips and bright pebbles, and the sky was aglow with a hot, soapy radiance that dissolved the horizon and washed out all colour and altered shape and substance. Far ahead of them, Santen saw the humped shape lying, and beyond it the four Chemsbok cows lingering loyally but fearfully by their fallen liege bull. They abandoned him at last only when the little file of human shapes was within a mile, and they galloped away into the shimmering heat haze. The bull lay as Owa had mimed him, panting and so weakened by the poison of the arrowhead that his head rolled and his long, straight, annulated horns waggled from side to side. His eyes glistened with tears, and his eyelashes were as long and curved as those of a beautiful woman. Yet he tried to rise to defend himself as Owa faced him, and hooked with those rapier horns that could impale a full-grown lion, swinging them in a vicious, flashing arc before sagging back. Owa circled him cautiously, seeming so frail against the animal's bulk, waiting for his opening, the clumsy spear poised, but the bull dragged its semi-paralyzed body around to face him. The arrowhead still dangled from the wound beneath his ear, and the lovely black and white pattern of his face mask was smeared with dark coagulated blood from the poisoned wound. Santan thought of Nuage again, and she wanted the suffering to end quickly. She laid down her satchel, loosened her skirt and held it like a matador's cape, and sidled up to the stricken bull on the far side from Owa.
"Be ready, Owa, be ready."
The bull turned to her voice. She caped the bull, and he lunged at her. His horns hissed in the air like a swinging cutlass, and he dragged himself towards her, kicking up dust with his giant hooves, and Santan leaped nimbly aside. As he was distracted, Owa rushed forward and lanced the bull in the throat, driving the bone spearhead deep, twisting and worrying it, seeking the carotid artery. Bright arterial blood sprayed like a flamingo feather in the sunlight, and Owa leapt back and watched him die.
"Thank you, great bull. Thank you for letting us live."